In a lecture presented by Environment Hamilton, Professor Pierre Filion from the University of Waterloo School of Planning tried to explain why mid-sized cities like Hamilton have a dying downtown core. Instead of finding ways to increase the density of residential living in the core, developers concentrated on the expansion of suburbs, especially in mid-sized cities. The city's core fell victim to failing retail, leaving lines of empty buildings, and as Jane Jacobs would call it, death rot from within. I would also like to add another perspective to his analogy, though. Hamilton's downtown fits the description of a successful downtown only if it was still back in the decades of the 1920s to the 1950s. When the 1960s were ushered in, our mindset was changed. The car was embedded into our society as an appendage of ourselves. It was marketing by early corporations like the Ford Company that found ways to mass produce the car, thus creating a demand which eventually destroyed the downtown of many cities across Canada. Far reach? Maybe not. At the time, Henry Ford was trying to do a service. Did Henry Ford envision the results of his production on the future? Did he look as far as seven generations, as our native kinfolk would say? Or was his vision myopically focused on immediate profits? Sure, he was a great employer. Staff were taken care of. But look where the convenience of the car has taken us in 50 years. Thousands of people are homeless because of lack of affordable housing. They don't lay on the streets in suburbia, but you can find them sleeping in cars. Back in the 50s and the 60s, the cars for teenagers served as a mobile bedroom. Best of all, it freed them to explore whims in solitude or with a group of friends. It was a status symbol of independence. Riding public transit became something to mock. It was an embarrassment. The demand went down. Those with cars were the leaders in society. They called the shots and offered a new lifestyle that promised a better social life. Developers took note and the suburbs were born, lauded as the only place to raise a family, away from the dangers that downtown living threatened. Largely, it was the idea of land possession that attracted buyers by the thousands to follow the developers' illusions. All new suburbs start with a glossy marketing campaign and promises of woods and nature walks and stores and peace and quiet. Except what they don't tell you. There is limited or no public transportation. If you don't have a car, the suburbs are isolation to the extreme. Housewives were left without the family car. They found the daily existence had become a serious problem of how to get supplies or how to get anywhere. Even the daily necessities like getting a quart of milk meant you had to get into the car and drive to the store. Nothing was within walking distance. Without a car, you had no way of survival. Living in suburbia had to become a two-car affair. That added more cars to the roads. And when the kids grew up, they too bought a car. Parking downtown now became impossible to find. Developers built large shopping malls to meet this need. Huge acres of tarmac and cement increased their spread over the farmlands that could no longer fight off the developers' pressures to sell. Large mall stores meant bulk shipments, which made items cheaper. But it was another death knell for downtown stores. In Hamilton, when Eaton's died, it took the core with it. But you still needed a car to get to these big box stores. And then you used the car to carry the purchases home. Nobody went downtown anymore. The face of streets changed to a clutch of empty, seedy-looking buildings broken away from the other buildings by large spans of cement that endlessly spewed cars out from parking lots. By building the Jackson Square Mall, planners were trying to bring the suburbs back down into the city. It didn't work, largely because people had to bring their cars with them to shop, and there was no parking. No parking on the streets for cars either. This allowed Main Street to be turned into four lanes of fast-moving vehicles. In effect, it became a mini expressway with everything just racing along, including transport trucks. Nobody could slow down to look into the store windows. The speed was just too fast. Walking along downtown streets became more dangerous. You never knew where automobile traffic would be coming from. The numbers of people walking along the downtown streets started to disappear. The suburb was the place to live. It was spacious, quiet, and if cars moved along too fast, you put a cement traffic bump across the road. It meant living in a place where there seemed to be some kind of control over your life, except over the costs that came with cars. The past decade of the increased cost of gasoline, parking, insurance, and vehicle maintenance has changed people's mindset, by force in most cases, to think about the benefits of living back downtown. They want to be able to walk to work, walk to stores, and find entertainment. If cities like Hamilton want to revitalize their downtown core, Dr. Fillion has three suggestions to break the cycle. Don't waste more money on downtown malls or by building more parking lots trying to suburbanize downtown. Rather, go back to what Main Street used to be. His theory was just to find two blocks, about half a mile of walking distance, and subsidize a retail market that would make living downtown attractive. Put in a sunset clause to end subsidies in 10 years. Then you change the zoning. You clean up the contaminated sites to allow for residential living. And then you simply wait. Dr. Fillion didn't seem too supportive of a currently popular cultural theory of using the creative class to encourage the demand downtown. But in my experience, wherever you find musicians and artists living, the desire to live their bohemian culture is an attraction. As long as there is entertainment, people will come. And now, here is Dr. Pierre Fillion.
One of the concepts that is inherent that make a healthy downtown areas is the concept of synergy. Synergy really means that you've got different activities that interact to the mutual benefits of those different activities. And this is a principle that is inherent to downtown areas. Synergy is trying to use the material you have to the maximum. Why are downtowns important? They are important for a number of reasons. There was an article not very long ago in the New Yorker that was about Manhattan. And they were saying that from an environmental point of view, if you look in terms of emission and pollution in general generated by square meters or whatever measure that we're using, Manhattan is the worst offender in the United States. This is where you've got the most pollution generated per square meter or square foot or whatever measure you want to use. But it was also saying that if you look at the amount of pollution that is generated per person, then Manhattan is the least offensive areas from an environmental point of view. Why? Because people in Manhattan use transit. People in Manhattan walk. Manhattan is developed at a very high density, so doesn't consume, doesn't encourage urban sprawl. And all downtowns are important. From an environmental point of view, they minimize the environmental impact of urban areas. A healthy downtown area that works well, within walking distance, you can reach a range of activities that is unequal anywhere else. You won't find that in the suburban malls. You won't find that in the big box stores. You won't find that in the power malls. At the very peak of land values, you will find financial corporations. Okay, so you've got the big banks, insurance companies, and so on. They're able to afford the peak. When you have land values declining somewhat, what do you find? You find retailing. You find mass retailing or exclusive retailing. The values decline still a bit more. What do you find? You find restaurants, hospitality, all sorts of different kind of restaurants. You can walk from one place to the other. Land values decline a bit more, so what do you find? You start finding more offbeat kind of restaurants, offbeat kind of stores, and so on. Land values decline a bit more. What do you find? You find secondhand shops. And all of that you can reach within a downtown area. And this is what makes the attractiveness, the strength of a downtown area. This is why they are important. They are not only important from an environmental point of view, but they're also important because of the diversity they afford. You don't find that anywhere else within an urban area. An urban area that doesn't have a healthy downtown, that has let its downtown go, is bereft of that. Doesn't have these kind of activities, is not able to offer that to its people. A comparison I like to make is between Detroit and Toronto. Detroit is the example of a metropolitan region that has basically no downtowns. This is why they have a people mover. So the people mover turns around and is supposed to connect all those different elements in the downtown area in Detroit because it provides such a poor walking environment. But it's no surprise that the people mover is generally empty, which doesn't matter because it doesn't have a driver anyways.
Right.
So it runs automatically. So there couldn't be any humans involved at all, and the people mover would still be going around, and this is more or less what happens. On a summer day, how many buses from Ontario do you find in downtown idling in downtown Detroit? How many buses from Michigan do you find in downtown Toronto? You find a lot of them. People go from Detroit to Toronto. Why? Because they want to experiment the downtown area. They want to experiment the lively downtown area because their own metropolitan region doesn't offer them such a downtown area. It is because they offer a lifestyle option within an urban area. If you don't have a downtown, you're condemned to live in a suburban type of environment. It means that you have to use the car all the time. Big cities attract tourists, in large part precisely because of their downtowns. They're downtown that attract. So when you put all those advantages together, it explains why in the larger cities, the downtowns have generally remained healthy. They certainly have in Canada. When you look at the downtowns of major Canadian cities, they're all healthy. In the United States, and you can see the connection here between downtown and transit, the cities, the metropolitan regions that have good transit systems have good downtowns. The metropolitan regions that have lousy transit systems have lousy downtowns. Phoenix, Arizona would be an example. Los Angeles, now they've got a subway and so on. They've tried very hard. Their downtown is improving and so on, but it is not one of the best ones. On the other hand, San Francisco, that has a much more extensive transit service, is a very lively downtown. And in fact, when you look at what's happened in Canada, you can see that downtown areas, nothing has happened in terms of construction in major downtown areas in Canada between 1931 and 1958, 59, 60. Okay, so you have about 30 years there where there's no development. Of course, there's some factors. There's the Great Depression that happens, then there's Second World War, and afterwards, after the Second World War, there's the big trend towards suburban expansion. But those cities, and I'm talking about Montreal and Toronto, have invested in subways. When you get into the 60s, all of a sudden you get a boom that happens in those downtown areas, and you've got an extensive redevelopment of downtown. Why? Because those public transit systems were bringing a lot of the people downtown. It was making so that the downtown was at a peak of accessibility. Now, let's move to the medium-sized cities and let's see how situations are different in the medium-sized cities. And they are indeed very different in medium-sized cities. For one, medium-sized cities have very little transit use. I don't know what it is in Hamilton, but I know in my metropolitan region, Waterloo region, it's 3.5%. And at 3.5%, it means that you only have captive users. Because anyone who has any possibility of any kind of choice will take that choice rather than using transit. So obviously, the fact that those transit systems are still largely focused in the downtown area doesn't help the downtown area very much. New patterns. In a large metropolitan region, you still have a conic. When you look at the land values in a medium-sized city, it's erratic. And in fact, in many medium-sized cities, the highest land value is no longer the downtown. It's going to be somewhere, some kind of suburban mall, where you're going to have the highest land values. The downtown is going to be somewhat lower than that. So as a result of the dispersion of those activities, there's not many reasons for investors to locate downtown because you can pretty much have everything you're looking for elsewhere than in the downtown area. As you can have a rising cycle in the successful downtown areas, whereby, you know, the more activities you have in the downtown area, the more attractive it becomes, the more it's going to attract people who want to live close by. And this is certainly the trend at the moment in large city Canadian downtowns. You've got a lot of condominium developments that take place there. The more condominium development that takes place there, the more it makes the downtown lively because the more people you have close by and so on. So you have a number of reinforcing factors. When you look at what happens in medium-sized cities, it's the opposite effect. You've got a downtown where that is perceived by a lot of people as being threatening. I know we've carried out focus groups in Waterloo region, and we are asking people, you know, what are the parts of the metropolitan region you perceive as attractive and the parts you perceive as being not attractive? And what came out as an answer, nearly invariably, the attractive parts of the metropolitan region were either parks or outlying areas, the surrounding countryside. On the other hand, though, something else that we've discovered in our work in Waterloo region is that you've got a certain proportion of people. It's about 20 to 25%. And, you know, we found out that in other circumstances, you have, again, the 20 to 25% of the people who are clearly stating a preference for something else in the suburb. okay, and not the rural areas. They'd like to live in a more urban environment and a more lively environment than in the suburbs. They would like to live in an environment where they don't need to use their cars all the time. But the problem that they were expressing is that they'd like to do that, but they can't do it close to downtown Kitchener because downtown Kitchener doesn't offer them what they're looking for. It is too depleted. There's no food stores. There's no grocery stores. There's a market. But, you know, like someone said, well, you can buy some things in downtown Kitchener. And, you know, I walk there to buy everything I can, but I can't buy cat food in downtown Kitchener. Okay, so I've got to get in my car or go to the big supermarket, get my pet food, and come back. So the idea of living in a downtown area where you don't need to use the car is defeated by the fact that the downtown area doesn't offer the wide range of services that you need in order to have a population there. If only you had good retail downtown, you had good lively street, people would come and live in. You wouldn't need to give any incentives. You could even have high development charges. Developers would still come because that would be an attractive area. If only you had a lot of people living close to downtown, you would have a lively downtown because retailers, you know, they would adjust the market. So you would have your grocery store. After all, you know, in Toronto, you have the downtown type Loblaws, you know, in the St. Lawrence neighborhood. They've developed a concept of a downtown supermarket, and you could have that as well. But the problem is, where do you start? When you're in a vicious cycle like that, you need to break it. My idea about that would be to subsidize. But think about all the money that was spent in terms of urban renewal efforts on downtown areas over the last 35 years. Mega millions of dollars have been spent. The public money that went into subsidizing indoor shopping malls in downtown areas. The public money that went into subsidizing, you know, complexes, you know, like Jackson Square and so on. The amount of money that went into making downtowns more friendly to the car. You've got two blocks. And in those two blocks, you subsidize retailing to have a retail mix that will be attractive to people who would come to live close by. You've got a sunset clause to that. In 10 years, it's going to be over. At the same time, you make sure that there's land available and zoning is all clear and so on, that the land has been decontaminated for housing purposes, there's land close by and so on. You make sure that all those factors are in place and you just wait for it to happen. And I'm quite sure that would happen because I think that the main obstacle at the moment is those key parts of retail and also that little sector of the downtown that would be adapted to close by residents that is not in place. You put that in place, I think then you will start having, there's the expression again, synergy that would kick in and it would happen and then it would start spreading. It may involve a lot of money, but it's much less than what has been spent in the past to try to revitalize downtown areas. And what it has done was to suburbanize the downtown area, and that ended up being a major problem. The survey that we've done of successful downtowns and not so successful downtowns in North America. The purpose of that survey was that often, you know, I was going to talk to municipal officials, and the impression that I was getting from people in mid-size urban areas was always, oh yeah, we're having so many problems with our downtown isn't doing very well, and there was always the impression that we're worse than anyone else. Whereas, you know, us going from one place to the other, we soon realized that that wasn't the case. I mean, the same problems were everywhere. That in fact, the norm for mid-sized cities was to have a problematic downtown, was to have a declining downtown. That was the norm. It was the exception that seemed to do well. So the purpose of that study was to identify those exceptional downtown areas and to try to derive lessons from them. Essentially figure out what they've done right or what just happened to work in those downtown areas that then can be generalized in other kind of circumstances. So what we did is that we sent an emails to 1,076 persons. And those people were selected as follows. 371, about 35%, were to university planning, urban studies, and urban geography faculty members. 46.8%, the biggest amount, was to planners employed by the central cities of small metropolitan regions. And about 20% were to urban professionals working in other fields, you know, consultants, think tanks, and so on. We define mid-sized cities or mid-sized urban areas as urban areas with populations between 100 and 500,000. So technically, Hamilton is just slightly above that threshold. we'll be looking at cities that are just slightly smaller than that. I'm confident that the results you're going to find that also pertain to a metropolitan region like Hamilton. Websites of North American University Planning, Urban Studies, and Geography departments and programs, and websites of organizations involved in downtown revitalization and urban research in the U.S. and Canada. Next, please. 859 research destination. After two reminders, we got nearly 300 responses. So that's a 34.4% response rate. So question one listed 19 potential influential factors in the success of small metropolitan region central business district. The residents were invited to rate each factor on a 1 to 4 scale from 1 very important to 4 not important at all. And we also asked them for comments on those questions. And bear in mind, we're talking about planners. So it's an expert-based kind of survey. The reason we did that, because they were easier to reach. And secondly, because we can assume that planners would know something about these kind of matters. The difficulty we're facing there is that people know the downtown areas of mid-sized cities that are close to where they live. Mid-sized cities do not generally have a national reputation. So people know the ones that are close to where they live, and that's about the limit of their knowledge then. So, which means that when the results are going to come up, it's going to be difficult to compare them one to the other, that this one's more successful than the other ones because they're based on different samples. Question three, respondents were asked to mention and comment on any successful small metropolitan region downtown. No limit on the number of the downtowns that could be identified as very successful or successful. Which are the successful downtown areas of metropolitan regions between 100 and 500,000 population in Canada?
How about Kingston?
Kingston, two. So we've got two. So Victoria. Okay, so we've got the three successful ones in Canada. Urban professionals, mostly planners from the urban areas identified in the survey, were interviewed. What did they do wrong? Because this is part of a research project that involves the municipalities within Waterloo Region and the university. A group of planners from the different municipalities in Waterloo Region and some graduate students went to some of those cities and carried out interviews and so on. Incidentally, they went, I think it was late fall, and they went to the southern United States. Poor them, I felt so sorry about them. I was teaching then, so I had to stick around. Okay, next. There we go. This is an important one. Okay, so we're asking planners what they think is important in terms of features. Active retail scene is way up there. The second one is a pedestrian environment is way up there. Cultural activities is important. Street-oriented retail is very high, which is related to pedestrian environment. People on sidewalk related to that as well. Employment and well-preserved neighborhoods, the one that follows, and frequent transit, and then it starts going down. Now, look at what there is in the very important one. You've got the elements of the traditional downtown. Okay, so we're going back to the 1930s here, or 20s, before the Great Depression. So what do we have? We've got active retail scene, stores are there downtown, there's a lot of activity. We've got employment in the downtown. And also, very importantly, and it comes in the number of factors mentioned there, a pleasant pedestrian environment. A lot of people were there because it's a pleasant place to walk. Okay, so this is important. Let's look at the other extremity. Look at the one. There's one there, the last one, where not important, not very important, is higher. Then very important or important, it's retail mall. Now, this is interesting because a lot of downtown areas have gone in that direction. And I think that needs a bit of history there. When things started going badly for downtown areas, the interpretation that was given was that downtown areas were not able to compete with the suburbs because the suburbs had more modern facilities, had better car accessibility. And accordingly, what was perceived as being the solution to the problem of the downtowns was to replicate the suburban formulas right in the downtown by building those indoor shopping malls. They were not exact clones of suburban shopping malls. They were generally higher density. Some were on different floors. Some had structured parking. And most of them had structured parking on different floors. A lot of them charged for the parking as well. So there were some differences. But essentially, what they were trying to achieve was to compete with the downtown on its own market. Okay? Mass retailing. So if suburbs can do mass retailing, we can do mass retailing. And this is where they built those structures. That was high currency and planning 30, 40 years ago until the 80s, essentially. Planners, if we would have carried out the same survey 30 years ago, retail mall would have been to the left, way to the left. They would have thought this is the way of dealing with it. This is a solution. Historical character, they all have it except Rochester, Minnesota. Have street-oriented retail as by far their main characteristic. Variable. Downtown presence of a university. Athens, Burlington, Halifax, Iowa City, Kingston, Madison, State College. All those successful downtown have continuous street facades. And this is the recipe for a good, pleasant pedestrian environment. And this was said in 1961 by Jane Jacobs. The major danger to a walking environment is when you start developing surface parking lots. When it starts becoming car-oriented, it's no longer so much pedestrian-oriented anymore, that area. If the walking environment is broken by major obstacles that make it not pleasant, they're not pleasant to cross, people won't cross it, and that puts an end to where you've got the downtown dynamic. This is very present in U.S. cities, where it was fashionable in the 50s and 60s to build ring roads, you know, ring expressways around the downtown. And you see, that basically confined the downtown area to that area, prevented a lot of interaction between the downtown area and the surrounding residential neighborhoods. And as a result, the downtown area is deteriorated. It had very good car accessibility, but it had lost the other kind of synergy that existed between residents and downtown functions because people didn't walk across anymore. Different things that are favorable to downtowns at the moment. Number one, declining appeal of the suburb. Like I was saying before, you've got a lot of people who are fed up with the suburb. Okay, for them, this is no longer the urban ideal. Okay, they'd like to live in another kind of environment, an environment which is more active, which is walking, more spontaneous as well, you know. They'd like to go in a cafe and meet people they haven't seen for a long time in a spontaneous fashion and so on. And downtowns are a bit idealized, I admit it, I confess it, you know. Downtowns, all that doesn't necessarily happen in the downtown area. Suffice it to say at this point that you have a lot of people who are looking for an alternative to the suburbs. Okay, different lifestyle. Aging baby boom cohort. So you've got a lot of empty nesters who are going to look for somewhere else to live. And if downtown areas are revitalized, if they're pleasant, this is an ideal place to live. I mean, you get to a point in your life where you lose your driver's permit, you can still stay there because you can walk to the different destinations. You can't do that elsewhere. The creative class perspective. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that perspective. It's a researcher called Richard Florida who came up with that idea. And he's the darling of planners at the moment because planners like what he's saying, whether he's right or not. You know, what he's saying good things from a planning point of view. City officials like him as well. And especially when he says how cities could compete with each other. And people involved in cultural activities also like him a lot. But like I'm saying, that doesn't mean that he's necessarily right on everything he says, but you know, he's popular. Tell you what he says. He says that you've got about 40 million creative people in the U.S. Okay, focuses in the U.S. That he sees as belonging to the creative class. Okay, those are generally highly educated people, people who use, you know, a lot of their brains and new ideas and so on in the work they do. And for him, it covers a wide range. You know, it goes from the scientist, from the programmer, to the accountant, to the teacher. Okay. There's a lot of people in that 40 million. Another thing he says is that he says those 40 million people generate economic development because they come up with new ideas. They may start new businesses. They may come up with patents, with new ideas, and so on. So they generate economic activity. And he goes so far as to say that where in the past economic activity was generated by manufacturing and so on, nowadays it's the creative class that generates those activities. In my view, it's highly exaggerated what he says, but nevertheless, I told you I'm presenting his view. And he also says that those 40 million people can go and decide where they want to live. Okay, they're not forced to live anywhere. They can move, and wherever they move, they bring along with them their economic development potential. And the example that are given, you know, are people who live, who leave Cleveland because they don't like living in Cleveland anymore, and you go to, say, San Diego, and then they bring, you know, the creativity, the activity, and so on to San Diego, and it's a loss for Cleveland. And in his view, then, metropolitan regions compete against each other for these kind of people. These are the kind of people they'd like to attract. Thank you.